Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation. Today's candidate is the vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is a super important nutrient. We hear about it all the time. Everybody's heard of B12, even if it's just, you know, your mom talking about getting a B12 shot or you know, your neighbor doing well with B12 or all the talk about, you know, if you're vegetarian, where do you get your B12? So I want to go into a lot of detail about B12. I want to teach you the mechanisms for how it works, some of the biochemistry for it, the things that interfere with it, the things that enhance its absorption. We'll look at how it's absorbed, and we'll look at food sources and other sources where you can find B12, and how much do we really need? So before we begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that anything I present to you and that you present to your clients is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. It's just a sharing of education from our experience to theirs and from my experience to yours. And you always have to encourage your clients and patients to make their own health care decisions in conjunction with their qualified healthcare professional. Now, qualified healthcare professional is you in a sense, but if you're not licensed to do that sitting face to face with somebody, you just have to be careful that you're not diagnosing or treating, that you're just offering some suggestions and education. So let's talk about vitamin B12. It's part of the B complex family of vitamins, as we know, and it's water soluble, as are all the rest of the B complex. But it's the largest and the most complex in chemical structure of all the vitamins. And it contains something that most of the other vitamins don't contain, which is a metal called cobalt. And that's why vitamin B12 is also known as cobalamin. You might have seen methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin, and we'll go through all those different forms. But yeah, that's why it's called cobalamin, because it has cobalt. So it's also in the center is this cobalt, but it has this group of molecules around it called carotenoids. And methylcobalamin and 5-dehydroxyadenosylcobalamin are the forms of B12 that are used in the body. Some of the other forms which we'll look at are intermediates, but they're not the active forms. The cobalamin is the cofactor for two different enzymes. One is called methionine synthase, and the other is called L-methylmalonyl coenzyme A mutase. And I'll show you where those fit. You're not going to have to memorize those, but it's good to know when you're thinking about a case where somebody maybe is taking a lot of B12 and is still showing deficiencies. When you understand some of these other cofactors and what it's a cofactor for, you're going to have a better understanding of how you can help that person. So here's the structure. We've got that corin ring, and there's 4 reduced pyrrole rings. So that's one of them. It's just showing you what it looks like. Cobalt is at the center. And there's a nucleotide called 5,6-dimethylbenzimidazole. And it also contains one of the following. And this is where the names of these come into play. So it contains cyanide, which is the most common form that we see in all the supplements and all the things that fortify the food, which is cyanocobalamin. It contains an OH, which is a hydroxyl group, and that's what hydroxycobalamin is. It can actually contain H2O, which is water, and it's called aquacobalamin. We don't see that as a supplement. We don't hear about that much at all. And then it contains nitric oxide, NO2, which is called nitric cobalamin. And then it can have 5'-deoxyadenosyl, which is adenosyl cobalamin. And then it could also contain a methyl group, which is CH3 methylcobalamin. So the ones you're going to see most commonly when you're talking to folks or seeing what they're taking is cyanocobalamin, which, like I said, is the most common, adenosyl cobalamin, which is one that really is helpful for mitochondrial function, and then methylcobalamin. Okay, those are the 3. Hydroxycobalamin you're seeing more and more lately because it's a form that it doesn't have much in the way of negative effects. The cyanocobalamin, the concern is if you're taking high dose cyanocobalamin, there's a lot of cyanide getting into the system. So we'll put this together so you can see what it looks like. And you'll see a lot of little circles and arrows on here, but I was trying to show you where all these pieces fit, right? So in this corin ring is out here, and that's this circle here, right? Then the cobalt is in the middle. So it's in the middle of that corin ring. And then there's a pyrrole on either side. And then there's the dimethyl blah, blah, blah. I don't even want to try to pronounce some of these words over here. Okay, and then you'll see in up here where we pulled this out, it's attached to this cobalt in the middle. We pull it out. That's going to either be your cyanide, your hydroxy, your water, your nitric oxide, or your methyl, or your hydroxyl. So that's basically what it looks like. It is a complex molecule. You don't have to memorize it. You don't have to be able to spit out all these chemical names of what's included. But what you do want to do with this is when you're reading the research, if you're looking something up or trying to understand it, that you kind of understand what all these components are. And the main thing to know is that it's the cobalt in the center, and then it's got one of the following hanging off that cobalt, and then a bunch of other chemical structures around it. So this is just so that you can see the B12 structures compared. I've just put a little circle around the differences. So this is the methyl at the side. You can see the methyl group there. And the second one is the hydroxy. You see the OH group there. And then the cyano, you can see that there's cyanide in the middle. And then the adenosyl is a lot bigger than the cyanide, the methyl, or the hydroxy. It's a much bigger set of molecules, so you can see that at the bottom. Just not to confuse you, but to give you some information that helps you in looking at these things. So vitamin B12 has a complex absorption situation. It's not like you just take it and it goes right into the cells and it gets absorbed in the jejunum like everything else. It's generally speaking, it's a complex thing. So first of all, you need to have good stomach acid. So if somebody's suffering from low stomach acid, someone comes in with GERD and reflux and you suspect low stomach acid, chances are good they're not absorbing their B12. So even if they're eating a B12 abundant diet, they're not going to be absorbing it if they have low stomach acid. So the stomach acid's needed, and what happens is in the stomach, when it comes in, it's bound to proteins and it's released from those proteins by the action of the HCl. And we need a good concentration of HCl to do that. So then we have the free form of the vitamin, and that's immediately bound to a mixture of specific glycoproteins that are secreted by the stomach and the salivary glands. And those proteins protect B12 from being denatured by the HCl in the stomach. Even just in the stomach, this is even before the absorption happens. This doesn't happen to most of the vitamins, right? So it comes into the stomach. The proteins that are holding on to it are released because of the stomach acid. And then we get the free form of the vitamin. Then it's bound to another set of molecules called glycoproteins that the stomach actually secretes, salivary glands do too, and then that protects it. So now we've got the B12 has come in with one protein kind of guidance, and then now it's shifted around in the stomach, and now it's connected to something else. So we could see that having good stomach function is super critical for B12. Then it binds to intrinsic factor. The intrinsic factor is created by the stomach, but the actual binding to the B12 doesn't happen until the B12 makes its way into the duodenum. And then there's specific proteases that hydrolyze the B12, so they're called hydrolyzed R proteins. And the free cobalamin is released. So now we have this B12, it's like it's being jockeyed around, right? It comes in with one protein, and then in the stomach it gets shifted and it's broken up from that protein and put on another protein. And then it comes down into the duodenum and it's released again. It's free again, but then it's bound to the intrinsic factor. And then it goes down, and most of it's happening in the distal one-third of the ileum. So 1 to 3% of the intake is absorbed by passive diffusion, but the rest of it, 97 to 99%, needs to be attached to the intrinsic factor. So you could see for B12, there's a lot of places where this could go wrong, right? You could have a problem with stomach acid. You could have a problem with the stomach actually creating the intrinsic factor. You can have a problem with some of these proteins that have to be bound. And then, of course, if there's a problem in the distal ileum where it's supposed to be absorbed, then you can have a problem with the absorption. So on average, anywhere from 11 to 65% is absorbed. The average is said to be about 50%. Okay, so that's, if you're giving somebody a lot of B12 because the RDA is X, you've got to make sure that you're accounting for that. This is why so much of the B12 is done in sublingual drops. So sublingual drops, the B12 is in it, you put it under the tongue and it gets absorbed there. Or sublingual little lozenges where they melt under the tongue. Some people chew B12 gum. That's another way to get B12. But it's in the mouth where the absorption is happening and it just goes right into the system, into the bloodstream that way. Now, what we also want to look at is, well, B12 shots, those get right into the system. And then also the B12 in patches, which I've stopped using some of those patches, and we'll talk more about that later, because of the folic acid that are in them. So these are all the different ways that the B12 can get in. And the reason that we have people do either the sublingual drops, the sublingual lozenges, the skin route, the patches, or the nasal route, or the shots, is that there's so much room for error in that. So even if somebody has everything intact here, about 50%. Now, if somebody is impaired, a lot less of it's going to get absorbed. So let's talk about B12 transport and the storage. So after you take in B12, it gets into the bloodstream and can be measured in the bloodstream between 3 and 4 hours after it's taken in, after it's eaten. And there's a particular transport protein called transcobalamin. And there's several different ones, TC1, transcobalamin 1, 2, and 3. The main protein that carries the newly absorbed B12 is TC2. So 80% of the B12 then is carried by TC1. So again, a lot of transferring happening with poor B12, right? So it gets bound to the TC2 when it's newly absorbed, but then 80% of that gets moved to TC1 because that's the circulating storage form. All of the cells have TC2 cobalamin receptors. 2 to 4 milligrams can be stored in the liver. And given that the RDA for B12 is in the microgram dose, that's quite a substantial amount, the amount the person needs. For some people, that can last 7 years. For some people, that can last 5 years. And for some people, it may not last all that long. It depends on how much their B12 need is and how the mechanisms are for releasing it from storage. So about 1.4 micrograms a day of the liver stores are secreted in the bile. So the bile is secreted by the liver to help digest fat, and it will say, oh, I got this B12 storage here. Here you go, just in case you need it. 1.5 micrograms a day is secreted in the bile to provide B12 in the absence of dietary intake. So here's a flow chart that shows how the B12 is absorbed. So we start in the mouth. The unbound B12 can be absorbed under the tongue. It moves to the stomach, where enzymes and acid cause the protein-bound B12 to detach from the protein. The R protein picks up the B12, that's secreted by the stomach, and intrinsic factor is released. So that's what happens in the stomach. So the stomach plays a big role in this. And then when it gets into the upper small intestine, the duodenum, that R protein releases the B12, and the intrinsic factor picks up the B12. And then it travels on down, and in the lower small intestine, the ileum, the intrinsic factor dash B12 combination attaches to a receptor on the intestinal cell, and then that gets absorbed into the bloodstream. Now, some of the unbound B12 is absorbed into the intestinal cells through passive diffusion. Remember, we looked at that before, between 1 and 4% only. Once it's inside those intestinal cells, it attaches to transcobalamin 2 before it gets into the bloodstream. So that was all in the ileum. It gets moved into the endothelial lining. It gets absorbed into those cells, and then it attaches to transcobalamin, and then it gets put into the blood. So the transcobalamin 2 carries the B12 to all the body cells where it's used and to the liver where some of it is stored on transcobalamin 3. So transcobalamin 3 is the protein that binds to the liver storage. Transcobalamin 2 is the one that carries it when it first gets absorbed. And transcobalamin 3 can circulate in the blood, but it's a very small amount. Once in the liver, the B12 is stored and released into the small intestine via the bile. Pretty complicated, hey? You can review those over and over. So here's what the absorption of B12 looks like pictorially. You'll see those little pictures of the proteins and of the intrinsic factor happening in the stomach. Goes down into the duodenum where the B12 combines with the intrinsic factor, goes all the way through that long 22-foot round until the distal ileum where it gets pulled into the cell. You see where it's pulled into the cell. That's where it gets attached to the transcobalamin 2 carrier, and then it gets into the bloodstream. So pretty cool, eh? So there's a video. I've given you the link to it. I highly recommend you watch it. It talks a lot about the B12 and the absorption, and you'll have that on the slide. It's nutritionfacts.org/cheapest source of vitamin B12. But it was an interesting one. So let's look at how B12 is metabolized. We've got hydroxycobalamin, and it gets methylated to methylcobalamin. Well, we have to have good methylation to have it be methylated, okay? It also gets reduced and reacts with ATP to produce adenosylcobalamin, okay? So that's the hydroxy. A lot of people are moving to supplementation with hydroxy when we have people with a combination of impaired methylation and so another SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, on their genetics called COMT, catecholamine O-methyltransferase. And what happens if that some of those people take too much methyl, because they're sluggish in processing through those COMT, the COMTs, they get what's called methyl trapping. Those methyl groups get trapped and we can't move the methylation pathway along. So in those cases, we go slowly with the methyl. We put them on majorly on hydroxy or adenosyl. And then with the methyl, we just add it slowly. I have someone I spoke to today who years ago, she was taking like 5 grams a day of methylcobalamin, and she still showed signs of B12 deficiency. She still had MCV that was elevated, which is large red blood cells. And she still had a lot of the symptoms, you know, kind of tingly symptoms. And her homocysteine was fine. I think we didn't do her methylmalonic acid. So that was the main thing, the main way we were looking. So when I learned about methyl trapping, I said, let's switch you off of the methylcobalamin and just put you on the hydroxycobalamin. Within 24 hours, her brain lit up again. It was that significant. Well, she recently went to an acupuncturist locally who said, oh my God, look at your SNPs, you need methylcobalamin. Why aren't you on methylcobalamin? Well, she put her on like methylcobalamin shots and gave her, you know, a whole bunch of high dose methylcobalamin. And what happened to her is she got agitated and she got irritable and she got anxious. And I said, well, it's because you can't process those methyl groups and you're stimulating that. And what happens is when they get trapped, you can't go through the full cycle of dopamine and serotonin breakdown. And it's aggravating. It's known to be a side effect. So she cut back on the methylcobalamin, and sure enough, she's feeling better. So we're going to eventually just inch her up on the methylcobalamin, but right now she's taking a few hundred micrograms of it. And then the adenosyl is the cofactor in the formation of succinyl-CoA, which is part of the Krebs cycle. So I've had really good results with supplementing people with low energy and some healing problems, immune system problems, with taking the adenosylcobalamin, like having their energy just like go up and their brain fog go down. And then cyanocobalamin is it's a very expensive and messy conversion to methylcobalamin. I don't want to go through that whole pathway, but it's just not an easy pathway to get it converted to methyl. And remember, methyl and adenosyl are the two that are the active forms in the body. So all of the others have to get converted somehow into adenosyl or methyl. So what influences vitamin B12 absorption? Well, there's a lot of things. So things that decrease it is age. A lot of people over the age of 50 lose the ability to absorb it. Why? Because probably the stomach acid's going down. It's years and years of diet, lifestyle abuse. And, you know, we see that a lot where people's stomach acid gradually declines. People who have had any kind of gastrointestinal surgery, like weight loss surgery, like, for example, gastric bypass. Certainly with a gastric bypass, think about that. What happens is they are cutting off most of the stomach. There's a little tiny piece of the stomach left. So anything related to stomach acid and intrinsic factor and the things that have to happen in the stomach are not going to happen. Because typically with a gastric bypass, the food goes into that little pouch in the stomach and then immediately goes down, bypasses the duodenum, and goes right down to the jejunum. So with B12, everybody that has had a gastric bypass has to take B12. Has to. There's no way. And have to take it sublingual or patches or shots. Because it's the only way it's going to work. Because they don't have the digestive tract. They don't have all that stuff that happens in the stomach, right? Intrinsic factors, the protein binding, and all the stuff that happens in the duodenum where they attach to intrinsic factors. So with somebody that has had in their history gastric bypass surgery, you absolutely have to do it. If somebody's had an ulcer surgery where they've had part of their stomach removed, or they've had ulcers for a long time and there's a lot of scar tissue in there, they're not going to have the efficiency of B12 absorption. Diseases like celiac disease or Crohn's, which can affect that ileum and the absorptive surfaces, people like that are going to have problems. Well, certainly people with H. pylori infection and ulcers. So H. pylori will decrease the stomach acid. So if there's an H. pylori infection, they're inevitably going to need to take extra B12 in a non-swallow form. It's going to be more of a sublingual or patch or injection form. And then pancreatic insufficiency, because remember there was something that the pancreas had to secrete to the proteases that it had to secrete to break the B12 off the protein that the stomach put it on and allow it to be free so it could attach to intrinsic factor. So if there's pancreatic insufficiency, especially of proteases, that's not going to happen. So let's look at the bright side. What will help people increase their absorption of B12? Well, adequate stomach acid. Intrinsic factor. And you know, there are intrinsic factor antibodies that people get. So if you've got somebody who has one or two autoimmune diseases, you can't just assume that they're making intrinsic factor, because it's likely that one of those autoimmune conditions is affecting that stomach. And it's expensive to go test it all. You certainly can, but it's easier and less expensive and less invasive for them to just be aware and supplement with sublingual forms or skin forms or injections of vitamin B12. When people take very large supplemental doses, then it causes the absorption to go down. And that's true of most vitamins. There's a higher percentage of absorption in the low doses than there is in the large doses. That doesn't mean that sometimes we can't give people large doses, but know that, say you give somebody a dose of 1,000 micrograms, and I'm just making these up for the sake of looking at an example. I don't know if these are the exact numbers, but say at 1,000 micrograms, the B12 absorption is 50%. And at 2,000 micrograms, it drops to 30%. They're still getting more usable vitamin B12 at the higher doses, but you've got to realize that the higher the doses, the more waste there is because there's not as much going. So you just want to find the right amount for people. And then, of course, good pancreatic function. And we can tell this if we do a stool test. There's something called elastase, which is a pancreatic function of their enzymes. So what does good old vitamin B12 do? It does a lot. It helps with energy production. Helps reduce chemical called homocysteine, which has been implicated in heart disease. It helps to protect the nerve cells, which is why when somebody is deficient in B12, there's a lot of neurological symptoms. It supports the replenishment of the myelin sheath and the maintenance of the central nervous system, which means it's a super important nutrient for anybody that's dealing with something like MS, right? Multiple sclerosis, where that myelin sheath is being destroyed. It's important for protein metabolism. It's very important for it. Those methyl groups are pulled off and sent into DNA and RNA repair and production. So it's really a super important vitamin, and it's really important to make sure that you don't cause people to become deficient. And you can cause people to become deficient, and I'll show you that in a bit. It works very well with B9, which is folate. B9 folate works with the B12 and the maturation of red blood cells, which is why we look at on the blood, we look at MCV as a possible mean corpuscular volume as a possible indication of B12 or folate. It's not specific to either one. It's usually one or the other when the MCV is elevated. It's usually one or the other when the MCV is elevated, but it doesn't have to be. So it's usually. But then you have to differentiate further, and when we talk about the ways to test for B12, we'll tell you that. B12 helps iron work more efficiently. So the combination of B12 folate helps iron work more efficiently. It also, with the B9, when you combine it with the folate, it helps better to produce the S-adenosylmethionine, SAMe, which I'll show you in a bit on the flowchart. So let's look at the two active forms of B12. So methylcobalamin, 60 to 80% of all the B12 in the blood is methylcobalamin. It's used by the enzyme methionine synthase to turn homocysteine, which is a toxic element, into methionine. And then methionine gets converted into SAMe, which is the most important methyl donor. So if you don't have enough of this, you get a buildup of homocysteine. Right? So somebody who comes in with high homocysteine, one of the things that you're thinking about is, do they have a B12 deficiency? And in fact, this is one of the few conditions that Western medicine is now starting to recognize as a nutritional deficiency. And a lot of mainstream doctors are now being taught that if you see high homocysteine, to give that person a supplement that contains B6, B12, and folate. So it's really good news that we're moving in the right direction. So that's the adenosylcobalamin. I'm not going to say that whole big long. It's 5-deoxyadenosylcobalamin, but we just call it adenosyl. It's about 20% of the B12 in the blood. And it's used by the enzyme L-methylmalonyl-CoA mutase to convert methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA. So let me talk a little bit about that. Both magnesium and biotin are required to produce this. Methylmalonic acid is a chemical that can be measured in the blood. I usually measure it in the urine. If it's elevated, it suggests that there's a B12 deficiency. In fact, it's the gold standard for testing for B12 deficiency. And the reason is that if you don't have enough of the B12, you're not going to be able to convert that methylmalonyl-CoA to the succinyl, which is for energy, right? So it's kind of like the pathway gets stuck and you can't go further because the only way to break it down is to have enough B12. So the gold standard for testing for B12 is the methylmalonic acid. I usually do it in the urine, although some people do it in the blood. So there's a lot of this adenosyl that happens in the mitochondria, this action, because it's part of the Krebs cycle for producing energy. So there's a couple of things you're going to see here. If there's not enough of the adenosylcobalamin, then you're going to get that buildup of methylmalonic acid. And you're going to have low energy because the Krebs cycle can't come to fruition as efficiently without the succinyl-CoA. It's used also by an enzyme called leucine aminomutase to convert B-leucine to L-leucine and vice versa. So this is an important thing in protein synthesis. And of course, the B12 deficiency, like I said, leads to a buildup of methylmalonic acid. So let's look at the relationship between B12 and homocysteine. Homocysteine is toxic to both the nerves and the vessels, the blood vessels. Methionine is an essential amino acid. It needs to be in the body. Some of the methionine is turned into homocysteine, and we'll look at the pathway to do that in the methylation pathway. Normally, the body takes the homocysteine and converts it back into methionine. But if it's deficient, if that pathway gets blocked as a result of not enough methylcobalamin, then that homocysteine builds up. And that homocysteine then becomes toxic to the nerves and also to the blood vessels, which means that it's a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So let's look at a little bit more detail on homocysteine in heart disease. It's thought to cause cardiovascular disease by causing oxidative stress and damage to the blood vessel walls. When homocysteine is high, the risk of developing coronary artery disease doubles. And you have 2.5 times the risk of stroke. Not good, right? It increases the risk factor for cardiovascular disease, blood clotting abnormalities, and atherosclerosis. So if the right testing is done and it's caught, a lot of the heart disease that happens will be prevented. And I think about this because heart disease is rampant in my family, and both my parents died very young of heart disease. My mom was 56, my dad was 62 or 64, something like that, and it was sudden heart attack. Now, they didn't eat a real good diet, and they didn't take care of themselves, and I just wonder, they probably had methylation problems. We'll show you that pathway in a minute, because I do. I am double heterozygous for the MTHFR gene, but I also have some homozygous, means I got a gene from both parents for some of the genes like the MTRR and the MTR. So when those are deficient, as you'll see in the picture coming up, then conversion to take the homocysteine and convert it back to these helpful chemicals doesn't happen. So I just wonder if back in that time, that was back in the 90s, my parents had been tested for homocysteine levels, that we could have corrected the problem and prevented their deaths by a simple supplement of B6, folate, and vitamin B12. We basically have this pathway that converts the folate that comes in the diet into the methylfolate. And if somebody is deficient in the MTHFR gene, which I have two of those deficiencies, then they're not going to as efficiently convert it. That folate, that methylated folate, goes up here and it interacts with the B12. And once those things happen, if you have enough B12 and enough folate, you're going to have methionine that's produced from the homocysteine. Okay. The reason that we also look at homocysteine being an issue with B6 is that there's another pathway. This is the sulfation pathway that comes down from homocysteine. And the B6 is required to convert homocysteine down in the sulfur. And downstream of this is actually glutathione. So somebody can have low glutathione because they're low in B6 because they can't convert their homocysteine. So if you see somebody who has a lot of immune problems and seems to have problems with their oxidation in their body and inflammation in their body, and they've got a high homocysteine, you're suspicious of the B6 not converting to glutathione and then some problems with this methylation pathway. So the homocysteine gets converted by having enough B12 into methionine. If this builds up, it's a good chance that you've got either a deficiency of folate, B12, or B6. One of the side effects, one of the deficiency conditions that can result from B12 is anemia. And it's called macrocytic anemia, meaning that the blood cells, the red blood cells, are much larger than they should be. And that's what's measured in a simple CBC $25 test called MCV. So if you look at the picture, you see normal blood cells are a particular size, and megaloblastic cells, which are larger size, are much larger. It's because they haven't matured. It's because the B12, along with folate, is needed for the maturation. So when we call macrocytic anemia, we know it's macrocytic because we look and we say, oh, its MCV is larger. Megaloblastic is the name we apply when you see them observed under a microscope. So somebody takes the blood and looks at it. They're oftentimes used interchangeably, so just so you know. So let's look at folate and vitamin B12 along with the megaloblastic anemia. Folate is needed to turn uracil into thymidine, and that's an essential building block of DNA. So the thing is, that's how folate's related to DNA. Those uracil and thymidine are some of the bases that are part of the DNA. Of course, we need DNA for new red blood cell production and division. So when you're creating the methylcobalamin, a methyl group is donated from folate. So you've got the cobalamin sitting here. It is not methylated. The folate comes along and says, hey, have a methyl group. And B12 says, thank you very much. I think I will. And that helps to take the folate from the 5-MTH form, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, to the tetrahydrofolate form. That's the form that we need to make DNA. So if there's not enough B12, we have a buildup of the 5-MTH, doesn't get converted into THF, the non-methylated form of tetrahydrofolic acid or folate, and then we don't make enough DNA. So you see where you need both. You need to have the methylated folate, and then you need to have the B12 to take that group off and go around. Without adequate B12, the methyl groups become trapped, and it's called the methylfolate trap. So they sit there, and then the THF form of folate is not available, and you can't make the DNA for synthesis and repair, and that affects the anemia. That affects the ability of those red blood cells to mature because there's not enough thymidine to make the proteins that facilitate the maturation. That's how we get megaloblastic anemia. So let's take a look at this in a little bit more detail. We've got the folate pathway over here. We've got the 5-MTHF. That's the form that you can give somebody in supplemental form or the form that's created from that folate cycle. And we'll go way more into detail on folate if you watch that presentation. So the 5-MTHF comes and donates a methyl group to B12. And it becomes tetrahydrofolate, and it goes into the RNA synthesis. Meanwhile, by taking that, adding that methyl group, the methylated B12 can then get converted into methionine. If you don't have any methyl group coming through, you're going to not be able to convert the homocysteine to methionine. And what happens is you get a buildup of homocysteine. So you can have a high MCV and high homocysteine. Surely those together will indicate that we've got a B12 folate deficiency, one or the other most likely. And then again, we said that the homocysteine then gets converted down to there's an enzyme called cystathionine beta synthase that B6 is needed for to create it into cystathionine and then down to cysteine and then further down into glutathione. So it's complicated science, but even if you don't memorize all these pieces, I've had to look at these over and over again before I really got it. So study this, look at it, listen, because it's really critical to understand it, because then you understand why, well, wait a minute, I gave this person methyl B12 or methyl folate, and why didn't this happen? So it's complicated. It's not straightforward. So let's look again further at the role of B12 and folate in megaloblastic anemia. DNA is needed. We established that already. You need DNA to make new red blood cells and division. DNA is required to make any proteins in the body. So without the tetrahydrofolate form of folate, the DNA cannot facilitate the maturation of red blood cells. That can lead to megaloblastic anemia. Without adequate folate, new red blood cells, they start out as called reticulocytes, large cells, they divide very slowly because they're dependent on the DNA for division. So only RNA, not DNA, is needed to produce hemoglobin. So we end up with plenty of hemoglobin, but we don't have the DNA to produce the red blood cell maturation. RNA doesn't require thymidine. RNA uses uracil instead of thymidine. So the RNA works fine. Folate is needed to convert the uracil to thymidine. So hemoglobin is only dependent on RNA, and it's produced at a normal rate, which causes large red blood cells known as macrocytes. So we don't see necessarily low hemoglobin. We just have these immature blood cells called macrocytes. Let's look at how it's so important to be supplementing with B12 when you're supplementing folate. I never, ever, ever will give somebody folate without B12 because the excess folate can mask the deficiency of B12. So if you've got lots of folate, lots of uncooked greens, adequate THF regeneration occurs even in the absence of B12. So with very high intakes of folate, like over 800 micrograms, that can mask a B12 deficiency because you're not going to see the megaloblastic anemia. But what happens is the B12 deficiency is there and you can get nerve damage because the deficiency goes unnoticed. So the MCV still looks okay with large intakes of folate. So the large intakes of folate can bypass the need for the B12. So then the B12 deficiency goes unnoticed and it gets worse and worse and worse. And then as it gets worse, it prevents the production of the cells in the intestine to absorb B12. So it's like a snowball going downhill. They're rapidly dying and they need to be replaced using the DNA, but we're not getting that DNA as well. Let's talk about iron. Iron and folate and vitamin B12. You've got these things called, this indicator on the blood called MCV. That's the size of your blood cells. And sometimes we'll look and say, oh, this person doesn't have a B12 deficiency or a folate deficiency. Their MCV is perfectly normal. But you can't take that at face value. You always have to look at the iron to determine if indeed that's not a B12 deficiency. So here's the thing. Iron deficiency will cause small MCV, small red blood cells. B12 and folate cause large ones. Now, if you've got both an iron deficiency and a B12 folate deficiency, that MCV is going to look perfectly normal, even when the megaloblastic anemia is present, because it's like looking at the average. You got a bunch of small ones, you got a bunch of big ones. The average comes out to be normal. And this is what it bugs me. When people go to their doctor and they do a full blood panel, supposedly, and a CBC, and they don't do the iron. Because you can't really interpret the MCV unless it's super low, then you'd know there's probably an iron deficiency. But if it's normal, you can't tell. So I'm really keen on having people do their iron to see, to make sure that they don't have this superimposed. And it's very common for somebody who's deficient in B12 and folate to also be deficient in iron. Very common. So those are the things I want you to be looking out for. So what is B12 deficiency without megaloblastic anemia? Okay, I'm just going to kind of summarize this. The megaloblastic anemia, also called macrocytic anemia, is indicative of B12 and folate. We've already established that, right? So when there's neurologic disorders happen when the B12 deficiency gets bad. It can happen in the absence of macrocytic anemia in someone who is either taking a lot of folate or they're eating a lot of leafy greens, which contain a lot of folate. So it's really super important. You know, you put somebody on a diet, you have them drinking green smoothies, eating lots of salads and greens, and you make sure that you give them B12. Because this can be serious because you're not seeing the early signs with the MCV elevated, even though they are suffering from macrocytic anemia, and the neurologic damage goes unchecked. And we'll look at what those symptoms are neurologically. here's a couple of cases that I found. This is a guy named Lindenbaum, examined 141 cases of neurological problems due to B12 deficiency. 28% did not have macrocytic anemia. Now, they claimed that about 6 of them might have had iron deficiencies. That's why it probably didn't look like that. And the others were taking folate. So the labs showed very high serum MMA, methylmalonic acid. And like I said earlier, I usually like to check it in the urine, but serum is fine too. I think the urine is a little bit more specific and sensitive. They found high homocysteine. And then the B12 levels in the serum are not very useful. They're borderline or sometimes normal B12. So these two things together, high MMA and high homocysteine, points to the fact that it's a B12 deficiency. If it was a folate deficiency and B12 was adequate, the serum MMA would be just fine. The urine MMA would be just fine, but the homocysteine could be high. So what are some of the symptoms? Sensory loss. So, you know, numbness, tingling, peripheral in the fingers and the toes. What's called ataxia, right? That drunken gait. Just they're not getting the signals from their feet to feed back into their cerebellum to cause balance to be good. In some cases, dementia, right? Loss of memory, short-term memory, and then other psychiatric disorders. Another study, 2011 from Korea, 35 patients with vitamin B12 deficiency. Most had neurologic symptoms, none had anemia. So you can't rule out that they don't have a B12 deficiency just because their MCV looks normal. That's the bottom line here. You need to be looking at all of these things in combination. If they're level of MCV is perfectly fine, always ask them, what are you doing for folate? Are you taking a folate supplement? Do you eat a lot of leafy greens? Because if you're thinking that they may have a B12 deficiency, especially if they have any of these neurologic symptoms, then you can't just go by the MCV. You've got to get the MMA tested and look at the homocysteine. So those two have to be tested. I'll tell you, my son had a B12 deficiency, and as a family, I always had the kids take a B12 supplement, you know, probably a couple times a month. They'd take a sublingual as a high dose, etc. Well, what happened was he unbeknownst to me, he stopped taking them. He decided he shouldn't have to take supplements. He was eating a good diet, stopped taking them when he was about 10. And I remember him saying to me, like, how come my feet go numb when I sit on the toilet? I'm like, okay. And then a thought came, B12 deficiency. But he's taking B12. Well, when he got into teen years, it got really bad. He had numbness and tingling in his feet whenever he would sit on the toilet. And he started to have really bad, you know, depression and anxiety and symptoms that go with puberty to an extent. But I felt like it wasn't really puberty. I thought it was more extreme than that. So I got his urine MMA tested, and it was elevated. It should be below 3.5. I like to see it below 3. His was about 5. So I was concerned, and I said, you got to take B12. And he didn't want to take it, but I said, look, this can be long-term neurologic. I showed him a list of B12 deficiency symptoms. And I said, how many of these are you having? Oh, a lot of them. And in terms of psychiatric disorders, he was actually like hearing voices and seeing things. I mean, he was really having, he was very smart. He would say, I think I'm having olfactory hallucinations, Mom. He apparently looked it up on the internet. He says, I smell things that other people don't smell. And I see things that other people aren't seeing. So I'm like, we got to get you on this. So he takes a patch of B12. And 2 hours later, he comes to me and says, wow, can that work that quickly? I said, what do you mean? He said, the voices in my head are gone. I always have this noise in my head and it distracts me, and it's gone. It's quiet. So I had him do that patch consistently. He did it consistently for 3 months. We retested him and his levels were normal. But then he stopped taking it. And a couple of years later, I think it was when he was a senior in high school. So he actually built up a store for a few years. But when he was a senior in high school, he says, Mom, you know, that tingling in my feet is starting to come back. I need to take some B12 again. And so now he does it regularly. If he goes too long without it, he knows, and he keeps it good and his, mood is good. He's not having, crazy hallucinations anymore. That's the power of this stuff, right? So don't discount how a simple vitamin supplementation can change someone's life. Okay? Really, really important to see. So let's look at what's pernicious anemia. Pernicious anemia is similar to megaloblastic macrocytic anemia in that it presents the same way, but it's because the stomach cells can't make intrinsic factor. We call it pernicious anemia. It could be because of an autoimmune condition. It could be because of other issues going on in the stomach. It could be an ulcer and all the other possible causes we talked about earlier. So the symptoms: weakness, pale skin, diarrhea, weight loss, fever, numbness or tingling in the hands and feet, loss of balance, confusion, memory loss, moodiness, all signs of B12 deficiency. The solution is B12 in high doses, ideally injections, but it can also be the patches. It can also be sublingual, and nasal is very good as well. We'll look at that when we look at supplementation. So here's just a list of some of the symptoms of B12 deficiency. And if it gets severe, permanent nerve damage can happen. So I don't know with my son if he's got some permanent nerve damage there. I don't think so, because it comes and it goes. But it's really good to not let it get to the point where they're having neurological symptoms. So fatigue and weakness, shortness of breath, pale skin, loss of balance, heart palpitations, inability to sleep, difficulty sleeping, insomnia. He had that. Abnormal gait, so they can't walk straight because they're not getting the right feedback from their feet and the proprioceptors there up into the cerebellum. Loss of concentration, he certainly had that one. Disorientation, memory loss, diarrhea, nervousness, that numbness in the tingling in the hands and feet. You might see it called stocking and glove paresthesia. Right? Because it's your feet and your hands, right? Stocking and glove paresthesia. And paresthesia is the name for numbness and tingling, for a nerve interference. Anemia and pernicious anemia, like we talked about before, looking at the MCVs. Swelling of the myelin fibers, which is going to have some of that, contribute to some of that gait stuff. And then possibly dementia. So there's a lot of things that can be really severe as a result of B12. So it's not a vitamin to take lightly, and it's not something you want to look at letting it go. So the risk factors for B12. Impaired stomach acid, we talked about that already. So H. pylori, ulcers, damage to the stomach cells that make intrinsic factor, atrophic gastritis. So anything going on in that stomach, you want to think, oh, we got to make sure we get B12 in them. Intestinal malabsorption, so Crohn's disease and other inflammatory bowel disease that can be affecting those ileal cells that absorb it. Pancreatic disease, so you're not producing the proteases to break the B12 apart from that protein. Bariatric surgery, we talked about that already, right? The gastric bypass, and medications can affect that. So specific populations that tend to be at risk: vegan and vegetarians and the elderly. So let's just briefly talk about vegan and vegetarians. There's a lot of talk and research on, well, we should be able to get B12 and make it in our bodies, because that's where we're really supposed to do. You get it from the soil. There's organisms on there. You take those in and it makes your B12. But the studies are showing that that doesn't always happen. It does happen sometimes, but so many things throw that off. The condition of the gut flora, which most people's deranged because of antibiotic use and alcohol and sugar and all that. It's where those organisms are. So those organisms they found in some people have migrated into the large intestine when they really should be living in the small intestine by the ileum. So there's a lot of considerations here. I would say you've got vegan and vegetarian populations, make sure they supplement. If they don't have symptoms, if they're not at a high risk, you don't have to have them supplement every day. B12 gets stored. I mean, you can have them take 2,000 micrograms once a week or once a month even for some. It's just a matter of playing it out. The liver can store it for up to 7 years. I did an experiment once. I've been vegan for 30 years. And at that time, I might have been for 24 years, 25 years. And I decided that I was going to go a year without taking any B12 other than just food-wise. I tested my B12 with the MMA the same time my son did, and mine came back as 1.7, perfectly fine. So I then started taking B12, but I take it on a sporadic basis. I do have some of those methylation issues, the MTR and the MTRR, that cause a problem with the B12. So I'm careful to make sure I take it periodically. But that just goes to show that from taking it before, I was able to build up my B12 stores. But everybody's different, so you just have to play it by ear with people. The specific conditions that can cause a problem, eating disorders, HIV, diabetes. And there's a book, it's called Could It Be B12? It's a really good book, and that's what I pulled out, and I started showing my son some of the signs and symptoms, and he goes, yeah, I have most of those. It's like, yeah, we got to get you tested. So don't overlook it. And we haven't done his genes. He doesn't want to see his genes. So we don't know if he has some of these genetics that are making it difficult for him to absorb and utilize. So B12 can contribute to fatigue. Oftentimes it's related to the megaloblastic anemia, right? Those blood cells are immature, so they're not going to be able to really carry the hemoglobin efficiently and do the exchange. So fatigue is actually the most common symptom of B12 deficiency, and there are a lot of just regular Western docs that are giving people B12 shots. They don't know how they're working, but they tend to work. People with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. Because B12 is a nitric oxide scavenger, the high levels of nitric oxide and peroxynitrate are linked to fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. So these folks benefit from B12 shots. If you have somebody who's dealing with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue for a long time, this is something to look at. I've given you references to most of these things in here. B12 can be associated with breast cancer. B12 and folate decrease the risk of breast cancer. Because the deficiency leads to impaired DNA synthesis and repair, when those cancer cells start to grow, which they all grow, we all grow cancer cells every day, and the body is able to just get rid of them. But if we don't have a good DNA synthesis and repair mechanism, if our DNA is damaged, we're going to have more growth of cancer. So B12 can help with that. When we look at postmenopausal women, oftentimes they're shown to have B12 levels, and they do have an increased risk of breast cancer. And when they've measured women with breast cancer, they do tend to have lower B12 levels than women without breast cancer. And there's a reference for that. So this is related to a lot of things. B12 and male fertility. Well, they found that B12 supplements improve sperm count and sperm motility. So it's, you know, somebody's dealing with what's going on here, and they're looking at very expensive and invasive interventions to try to get pregnant. Let's look at starting with supplementing that male with B12. There's other nutrients that are required there too. You know, zinc is another important one as well, but certainly B12 is something to not overlook. Deficiency in B12 can actually damage the sperm cells. So that's the way that it's caused. They've also found that insufficient B12 can damage the nerves in the penis that can lead to erectile dysfunction. So all these guys that are running around taking Viagra because they have erectile dysfunction, maybe they're low in B12. Let's look at B12 and macular degeneration. You see these two pictures. You see the macula in the first one where the arrow is. It's just a little dark spot. And the macula is on the very back of the eye, which is important for vision, very important for vision. So the B12 deficiency renders nerves, all nerves, right, but including the optic nerve, becomes more brittle. And that can cause damage to the optic nerve, and that decreases central vision. So when people are looking straight ahead, that vision is impaired. So, and in the second picture, you'll see that there's some degeneration. It's just broken apart, and there's just these little yellow spots that are where the macula should be, this one concentrated spot. So what do we look at? Well, 1,000 micrograms of B12 along with 2,500 micrograms of folate and 500 milligrams of B6 was able to reduce the risk of developing lost vision. So this is just a study that I gave you the link to. Impact of B12 excess. Well, it's rare, but it can happen. Mostly people tolerate it, even at high doses, with the exception of making sure it's the right kind of B12, because high doses of, say, cyano, you get a buildup of cyanide. High doses of methyl in a person that has some of the SNPs that cause the backup, the methyl trapping, you got to be careful of. But in general, B12 is safe. But the thing is that excess B12 can cause some of the same symptoms as deficiency, like numbness, tingling in the arms, hand, and face. So according to the NIH, people with a hereditary eye disease called Leber's disease can have damage to the optic nerve from excess vitamin B12. So it's kind of like a lot of things. It's the combination of environment and genetics. There's some studies that looked at increased risk of prostate cancer with B12, overdosing B12. They're retrospective. They look back. They look at the blood levels, which are not as accurate, and they don't provide specific ranges. So you can look at some of those studies and make your own decision. I just say, let's just find the right dose. Let's just not go to this point of excess. And those studies, when they did it, they used cyanocobalamin, which is the worst form of B12 to use, and they use synthetic folic acid, which has a lot of links to cancer formation anyway. So when you're looking at studies, you've got to really look at studies, like look at all the parameters and make sure that they're working properly. High dose supplementation or injections, and this is the way you get excess, is when if somebody's getting injections on a regular basis, they found that it can cause diarrhea, itching, blood clots, and allergic reactions in some people. Okay, so again, it's the Goldilocks principle, not too little, not too much, just right. And anybody, of course, who's allergic to cobalt should avoid taking B12 in the form of cobalamin. If they're allergic to cobalt, then they, of course, should avoid taking excessive B12 because that cobalt can become extracted from the B12 as it's utilized and it'll build up and they'll cause an allergic reaction. So all of the nutrients interact with other nutrients. Like we want a nice, big, happy family of nutrients. So folate, we previously covered that. It's related to the red blood cell production. It helps iron work better and produces FAMI. So B6 and folate together with vitamin B12 control the level of homocysteine in the body. You remember that pathway where the B6 lowered homocysteine going down and the B12 and folate going up and around. Iodine, improved thyroid function leads to riboflavin activation to form FAD, which is required for proper methylation. So if someone is low in iodine, they're not going to be activating enough of the B2 into FAD, the coenzyme form, which is needed for methylation and also in the Krebs cycle. So that's an important one. So make sure their iodine status is okay. And then magnesium and biotin are required to produce L-methylmalonyl-CoA, which then gets produced to succinyl-CoA. Okay, what depletes good old vitamin B12? There's a number of medications, anti-seizure medications like Dilantin, phenobarbital, primidone. There's some chemotherapy, and chemotherapy like especially methotrexate and doxorubicin. Colchicine, which is a gout medication. So these are all lots of medications that interfere with and deplete B12. So it's really good to get a good history of what medications, not just what medications your client is currently on, but what have they been on over the last 5 years. Because a lot of times, you know, suddenly people become more aware, they want to get off their medications. They may have gone off some of their medications in anticipation of getting a natural solution, and they may have been on these things which could deplete their B12. So some of the bile acid sequestrants, which are usually used as cholesterol lowering medications, cholestipol, colistimine, which is Questran, colsevolam, which is Welchol. So if they're on any of these medications, or anything similar to these medications. So make sure you look the medications up, because sometimes they're generic and they're similar to something that is pharmaceutical that has a specific patent. H2 blockers, right? So that's what people are taking to reduce stomach acid. Well, duh, if we're reducing our stomach acid, most of them don't need it, by the way, they mostly have low stomach acid, then that's going to affect the whole absorption of B12. So Tagamet, Pepcid AC, Zantac, all of those things are going to cause a problem with B12. Metformin, glucophage, which people are taking for lowering the sugar, and it's used in diabetes and insulin resistance very commonly. And then we have proton pump inhibitors that are used to reduce stomach acid. So again, anything that reduces stomach acid, whether it's a PPI or an H2 blocker. So Nexium, Privacet, Prilosec, Esifex, all of those can have an effect. And then finally, on the antibiotic side, tetracycline can have an effect. So there's a lot of medications that deplete B12. So how much do we really need? And you know that the RDAs are minimal, right? We need, generally people need more, and if they're symptomatic, they need even more. So we have ranges for pediatrics. So newborns only need 0.4 micrograms. And think about, an average B12 supplement is probably 1,000 micrograms. 6 months to a year, 0.5 micrograms, 1 to 3, 0.9, 4 to 8, 1.2, 9 to 13, 1.8, and then teenagers up to 2.4. And any adults, it's generally 2.4, unless you're pregnant or breastfeeding, in which case it goes up to 2.6 for pregnant and 2.8 for breastfeeding. Now, those are teeny tiny doses. If you think about the supplements that people are taking, they're much larger than that, mainly because it doesn't absorb real well. I think these RDAs are quite low. But if somebody has everything intact, you think about that. If somebody takes 1,000, like I was giving my kids when they were younger, I was giving them these, I think they were actually 2,000 microgram B12s, then they were taking 2,000 micrograms when they really needed anywhere from, 0.9 to 2.4 or 1.8. They could store a lot of that in the liver. Remember we said the liver can store milligrams, like 2 to 4 milligrams, right? So if they only really need this little amount, and I gave them 1,000 a month or 2,000 a month, they had plenty. They'd have their liver fully stocked, and then they could go from there. But some people may need more. Okay, like my older son. My younger son never got into that, but my older son, he needed more. Maybe a genetic thing, maybe a breakdown in one of the pathways, maybe not able to actually release it from the stores in the liver. So those are the things you want to look at. We just decided it was easier to look at having him take a supplement, mainly because he was already on a super healthy diet. So we're thinking it's more of a genetic factor or something like that. So it took care of it. But in many cases, you want to look at, like, why is this happening to this person? So some of the food sources, well, animal foods, meat, bacteria and fungi in the microorganism, they're the only organisms that are known to produce B12. Animals don't produce it. They eat it. But a lot of the animals that, like cows, they don't eat other animals, right? So where are they getting their B12? Well, they're getting it from the organisms that they're eating. They're not washing their food. They're getting those bacteria and they're producing them. So a lot of the times when we have germ phobia, triple washing of produce, we're eliminating the bacteria that would produce this for us. There's some that say that nutritional yeast grown on molasses is a food-based supplement that would provide a vegan source of B12. Some say that those are what's called analogs, B12 analogs, and not the real thing. The jury's out on that one. While there's some evidence that there is some B12 in some non-animal products, I think you just have to be cautious and be aware. Now, like I said, I'm vegan for 30 years. I take vitamin B12 every now and then, and I'm doing just fine. So it's just, but some people don't. My son didn't. He was vegan from birth. Food forms of B12. So the hydroxy form is found in poultry, fish, shellfish, eggs, and dairy. The adenosyl is found in poultry, fish, shellfish, and eggs, not dairy. The methyl form is found in dairy. The cyano form isn't found in food. tobacco, cyanide in tobacco can sometimes cause the formation of B12 cyanocobalamin, but not a reliable source or not a recommended source, obviously. So here's a list from the WH Foods. I love that site. They have a lot of great stuff in it. Food sources of B12, and it just lists them down. They're all forms that are animal products, except for mushrooms. Crimini mushrooms are listed. So I'd have to look to see where they're getting that from to see if it's actually a valid source. Maybe it is. So some herbs that are reported to be high in B12. Well, alfalfa, dandelion, hawthorn berries, hops, bladderwrack, white oak bark. The reports are unreferenced and anecdotal at best. So it's likely that these are B12 analogs, so I wouldn't want you to have people relying on it. If you want to do the research, dig in deeper. And I gave you a place to look. So how do you assess if somebody has the right amount of B12? Well, first and foremost, like everything else, you start with clinical assessment of signs and symptoms. You look at their food journals, you look at their diet history. That's where we want to start with pretty much everything. The blood testing, let's look at that. Well, the serum B12 test is not accurate. It only reflects the current and not the active forms. So it's not going to really give you an idea. Now, if somebody's super low on their serum B12 test, you can say, yeah, they have a deficiency. But if they're normal, they still may have a deficiency, and you've got to look at other more functional tests. So the MCV, mean corpuscular volume, is a good indicator, but there are other interfering factors, right? It could be folate. Homocysteine's a good indicator, but it might be folate or B6 if it's elevated. Methylmalonic acid is considered the gold standard. Serum is good, but the urine is considered better. There's a company called Norman Clinical Labs that I've used a lot. You can go to their site, www.b12.com, and check it out. And they have lots of great information about the testing. And then finally, there's something called the Schilling test, where you inject somebody with radioactive B12 and then do a 24-hour collection. That's not something we're going to be doing with people. It's an old test. It's something that was done, you know, long ago, but we don't do it very much. I don't know anybody that's doing that right now. So there is a good comparison of the test methods at the B12.com site. They have a separate subpage, which I've given you the link for. So let's look at B12 and methylmalonic acid. So what's the mechanism? Why is this a good indicator? Well, adenosylcobalamin is a cofactor for the conversion of methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA. When B12 is not available, methylmalonyl-CoA increases. When the methylmalonyl-CoA is then converted to methylmalonic acid, which then accumulates in both the blood and the urine. And it's a neurotoxin, by the way. Since B12 is the only coenzyme required in the pathway, only one, which is rare in a lot of these pathways, we know that this is a good indicator. If MMA is elevated, it means there's not enough B12. If MMA is not elevated, does it mean that there is enough B12? Well, there may not be enough B12 for other functions, so it's possible that you can miss a B12 deficiency there, but it's certainly considered the gold standard. So high MMA levels can sometimes be caused by, it's rare, genetic defects, kidney failure, low blood volume, gut bacteria changes, pregnancy, and thyroid disease. It's rare though. So the normal serum MMA is 0.07 to 2.7. Okay. Patients with serum MMA in the range of 0.76 to 187 had neurological problems. So you want to make sure that that person that you're dealing with, if they get the serum MMA done, that they're within that. And you can get this test done through Direct Labs and other labs. The normal urine MMA is 0 to 3.5. This test was developed by Eric Norman, PhD, in collaboration with the late Dr. Denton and co-workers at the Hematology Division of the University of Cincinnati. And I've had conversations with him on the phone, by the way. He's very friendly and very approachable because I called up when I first learned about this test many years ago. And he's very knowledgeable, and he told stories about his, you know, mother-in-law and her B12 deficiency and how it turned around and how they picked it up. So it's a pretty accurate test. So what kind of supplementation? Well, cyano, unfortunately, is the most common. It's the least effective, and it's not easily converted to the methyl or adenosyl, which are the active forms. Methyl is a metabolically active form. Adenosyl is metabolically active, and the hydroxy is easily converted to the methyl or adenosyl. Okay, so it's good. So how can we give people this stuff? Is like everything else, there's not just one method of administration. So intramuscular, boom, that's a shot. You got to go to the doctor for it, or get a prescription where you can do it yourself. So if you have a client that wants to do that, have them go to their doctor, see if they'll give them that to them. It's expensive to kind of go to the doctor every time you need a B12 shot. But I know people, I'm one 85-year-old woman I work with, she gives herself B12 shots. Intranasal, New Beginnings, has newbeginnings.com, I believe. They have a liquid form of B12 that I think is the purest on the market. It doesn't have a lot of excipients or colorings or flavors. A lot of people put flavors in their sublingual B12. But they don't have any of that, and they will actually say on when you order it, would you like a nasal bottle with your order? It's free, and they send it to you because they can't sell it as intranasal. They cannot sell it in that nasal body because then it's considered a drug. So they'll sell it to you, and they'll give you the bottle, and you could do it. It is messy. I've tried it. I have one. I popped it up in my nose, and it drips down. You can get a topical patch, but like I said, I haven't researched it recently. But years ago, at least a couple of years ago, when I looked at them again, after the whole folic acid versus folate issues come up, that they all had folic acid in them. So I don't use them anymore. A topical cream, I think it's New Biologics or Neurogistics, I think, has a topical cream. You can get liposomal vitamins are very helpful to take because, or anything, herbs can be taken that way too. They're encapsulated in these little liposomes that actually can penetrate through the gut wall and into what's called the chylomicrons and then taken into the bloodstream. And then they're easily penetratable into the cells themselves. You can get liposomal vitamin C, B12, folate, turmeric, a lot of things. Sublingual drops. The thing about the sublingual drops is that it's usually like 10 drops and you're like, okay, I got them to try to stay under my tongue, but some of them you may swallow. Sublingual lozenges are a little bit more predictable than the drops because they're going to melt under the tongue. Capsules, tablets, soft gels, you know, just typical supplementation. Of course, I prefer capsules versus tablets. And then lozenges where you can melt them. And gum. I first heard about the gum from Amy Yasko. I was at one of her conferences. And I'm like, gum? B12 gum? But sure enough, there's B12 gum. So a lot of these. Taking with water after eating tends to be the best. And the dosage range from 150 micrograms to 15. Now think about that. The RDA is 2.4, but the typical dose is 150. Huge discrepancy. That's unusual. Most things, the discrepancy between RDA and the ideal dose is much different, much less. So I've got some references for you. You're welcome to check out the references. And if you want to go deeper with it, there's a lot of deeper reading that you can do. I've presented as much as I can in our time together. I didn't want to make this 4 hours long, but this is, you know, where your homework is. If you want to know more, dig in deep. So thanks so much. This is Dr. Rita Marie. We'll see you on the next video.